In 1871, five young Japanese girls boarded a steamship bound for America, their silk kimonos fluttering in the Pacific wind. They were leaving behind everything familiar, language, family, food, customs, for a decade-long experiment that would test whether Japanese women could absorb Western learning without losing their souls. The youngest was barely 6 years old. The oldest were 14. None could have imagined they were about to become living bridges between two civilizations at one of history's most pivotal moments. This wasn't just a study abroad program. It was a radical gamble on the future of half of Japan's population, orchestrated by former samurai warriors who had once despised everything foreign. Their story reveals how education can become revolutionary, how identity can stretch across oceans, and how three young women would ultimately reshape what it meant to be Japanese and female in a rapidly modernizing world. When American warships forced Japan's doors open in 1853, they shattered 250 years of Tokugawa isolation, a rigid hierarchy where the emperor remained a divine figurehead while the shogun ruled from Edo. Tsutomatsu Yamakawa was born in 1860 in Aizo, a northern domain legendary for samurai loyalty. Then everything collapsed. In 1868, civil war erupted between imperial reformers and Tokugawa loyalists. 8-year-old Tsutomatsu huddled in Suruga Castle during a month-long siege, making ammunition cartridges while cannonballs crashed through walls. After defeat, her family was exiled to frozen wastelands where proud warriors faced starvation. The old Japan died in those bitter months. From its ashes emerged the Meiji era, a frantic rush toward modernization that transformed samurai into bureaucrats and defeated daughters into unlikely pioneers. Kiyotaka Kuroda embodied this paradox, a former xenophobic warrior who returned from America convinced that Japan's future depended on educating women. His logic was pragmatic rather than feminist. Educated mothers would raise enlightened sons to lead the nation. When Kuroda proposed sending young girls abroad for a decade, most families refused, fearing they'd return unmarriageable. The government recruited five girls from defeated samurai families with little to lose. 12-year-old Tsutomatsu received a new name, Discard the Pine, symbolizing her sacrificed heritage. 6-year-old Umetsuda knew only three English words. The 3-week Pacific crossing was miserable. Five girls crammed into one cabin, seasick and frightened. When a drunk embassy secretary molested 14-year-old Ryo, the men in charge showed little concern. These girls weren't students, they were experiments, their welfare secondary to the political statement their presence made. In Washington, they faced a new problem. Living together, they weren't learning English. The solution was radical separation, scattering them among American families who would remake their identities from the ground up. Tsutomatsu moved to New Haven with Leonard Bacon, a 70-year-old congregational minister who saw dual benefits in hosting her, financial support, and converting a heathen to spread Christianity in Japan. She bonded with his daughter Alice, whose intellect accelerated her English. Within months, she attended Grove Hall Seminary, though her brother Kenjiro ensured weekly Japanese lessons. Shige thrived with another minister's family, studying music and embracing Christianity under Aunt Nellie's care. Little Ume became thoroughly Americanized with the Landmans, excelling academically as her Japanese identity faded. The girls absorbed more than textbooks. They learned philanthropy through sewing for the poor, experienced freedom through hiking and skating, and witnessed women's intellectual equality impossible in Japan. By 1878, Tsutomatsu and Shige entered Vassar College as its first non-white students, becoming Japanese women with Western educations and hybrid identities belonging fully to neither culture. After a decade away, Japan felt alien. Tsutomatsu's Japanese returned quickly, but Ume, who left at 7, couldn't communicate and clung to Western dresses. Family reunions were polite, formal, emotionally muted. Most devastating, their expensive educations had no application. Their meeting with Kiyotaka Kuroda, the man who sent them abroad, proved crushing when he asked them to sing rather than discuss ideas. They were curiosities, not professionals. Shige's wedding showcased their liminal existence, a Christian ceremony in Japanese, the bride in Parisian fashion, a love match rather than arranged marriage. Then came Suta Matsu's impossible choice. Iwao Oyama, the 40-year-old minister of war, requested her hand. The twist was almost literary. Oyama had been a Satsuma warrior who fired cannons at her childhood castle. Her family rejected him, but political pressure mounted. Suta Matsu realized that as Oyama's wife, she might access power unavailable to even the most educated single woman. "What must be done is a change in society," she wrote, "and this can only be accomplished by married women." Ume resisted marriage, but found purpose teaching at elite schools, connecting with Hirobumi Ito, now a powerful minister who became her patron. Suta Matsu leveraged her position as a general's wife to advance women's causes, planning the Peeresses School and organizing Japan's first charity bazaar. She persuaded aristocratic ladies who never heard of charity to make and sell handicrafts. The event drew 10,000 visitors and raised 6 times expected funds. When Alice Bacon arrived in 1888 to teach at the Peeresses School, she and Ume shared a house symbolizing their bicultural existence. Ume on the traditional Japanese side, Alice in the Western portion. Ume later returned to America for graduate study at Bryn Mawr, focusing on biology and co-authoring scientific papers. Yet her vision remained surprisingly traditional. She advocated education so women could be intellectual equals to husbands and wise influences on children, not for independent careers. In 1900, Ume opened Joshi Eigaku Juku with 14 students and revolutionary pedagogy. Ume's teaching methods, requiring students to prepare before class, offer opinions, even disagree with teachers, were radical departures from Japanese norms, emphasizing memorization and deference. Within 6 months, enrollment doubled. By 1904, the school received government approval as the highest standard possible for a women's private school, exempting graduates from teaching certification exams. It cultivated independent thinking, not just English fluency. Tragedy marked their final years. Both Suta Matsu's and Shige's sons died when their naval training ship exploded in 1908. Emperor Meiji died in 1912, ending the era that made their journey possible. Suta Matsu died of influenza in 1919 at 60. Shige died of cancer in 1928 at 67. Ume died less than a year later at 64, her ashes placed on campus surrounded by plum trees. Today, Suda University thrives with thousands of women students who call themselves Umekos and visit her memorial before exams. Ume Tsuda now appears on Japanese currency, her legacy honored over a century later. Three girls left Japan in silk kimonos and returned as women in Victorian dresses, carrying degrees and divided hearts. Suta Matsu chose strategic marriage. Shige chose love and music. Ume chose education and lifelong singlehood. Their paths were messy, compromised, deeply human responses to being caught between worlds. Their story reveals a truth we often forget. Progress isn't linear, and pioneers don't always enjoy what they've dealt. These women fought for educational opportunities they themselves had already received, knowing the next generation would benefit from doors they had forced open. When you feel caught between identities, remember three girls on a steamship, leaving everything behind because someone believed women's minds were worth the gamble. Their legacy isn't just a university. It's the revolutionary idea that learning can transform entire societies, one educated woman at a time.